continue our meeting with a discussion of definition of a business, and I give the floor to Jim.
Jim.
Yeah, thank you. I think that the purpose of the slides and the discussion that we have is really to talk about the status of our project on definition of a business. Just a little bit of background. In the U.S., the definition of a business was applied in practice, particularly through regulatory interpretation and audit practice, in a way that I think many board members thought was inconsistent with the intent when the Converge standard was issued, and that is it was applied much broader than perhaps people had thought would be the case, to the point where examples where you bought a piece of land and there was a billboard on that land because you have, in some people's view, inputs, processes, and outputs, that is, you know, you've got a billboard that perhaps is generating cash flow that you acquired a business. Or maybe more real life examples, you buy a portfolio of homes for purposes of investment or resale, but one of those homes happens to be subject to a lease, that is, somebody's leasing that home right now, that is a business in and of itself because you're generating cash flows from the one piece of property that's being leased. And so it was very broad interpretations of what was a business, combined with the post-implementation review done by the FAF, that caused us to take a look at the definition. I think very similar to perhaps some of the reasons that the ISB also took a look at the definition of a business. So we understand perhaps in practice the definition was even applied more broadly in the U.S. than in other jurisdictions, notwithstanding the fact that the words were identical. Even differing accounting firms would have differing practice depending on whether the interpretation was a U.S. interpretation or an interpretation outside the U.S. So that caused us to, again, take a look at the definition. I won't go through, unless people want me to, slides 3 and 4 on the changes. I think the changes are by and large consistent with the changes proposed by the ISB, and obviously we have a discussion next where there are some, at least in my view, relatively minor differences at this point in the wording, but I'll be very interested in hearing sort of perspective as well and take that back to our board. We did post for comment our exposure draft in January. The comment letter period has ended. We received a relatively small number of comments, 37 of those. Major accounting firms accounted for 9 of those, 17 from preparers, handful from other, you know, professional organizations, so CPA societies and the like. Overall, commenters were supportive of the direction of the project. I would say that the questions were more technical in nature, that is, define what the term similar means. Define what this term, and we can walk through some of those, but it was requests for really, you know, definitional clarity. And a number of us, when we stepped back, really thought, and we thought this even prior to taking this on, that perhaps we're just pushing on a balloon. The real issue is, why do we have differences in accounting between business combination transactions involving businesses and transactions involving a group of assets that doesn't meet the definition of a business? And so while we can provide greater clarity, perhaps, in where that line might be, there are still going to be judgment calls, and as we saw even through this, you know, people seeking greater specificity because of the consequence of falling on one side of the line versus another. And we've added, we've really tackled this from our standpoint in what we're calling, you know, three phases. The first phase is the definition of a business itself. The second phase is important, at least in the U.S., because we've included within the revenue standard guidance on transactions not involving customers. So if you sell a piece of property, plant, and equipment, but if you're not in the business of selling PP&E, we've provided guidance that says the principles in our revenue recognition standard would apply to that disposal as well. And we went further and said it applies not just to non-financial assets, but in substance non-financial assets. that's a term of art that came from our real estate guidance, which said we had very specific guidance for disposals of real estate, and we said it applied to real estate and in substance real estate. In substance real estate, think of, I put a single property inside a corporate shell or some type of shell. Am I selling real estate or am I selling a subsidiary? And so, at least in our real estate guidance, we had guidance that said it didn't matter whether it's inside a legal entity or not. If it is in substance real estate, you follow the real estate derecognition guidance. When we did the revenue standard, we expanded the scope of that to say the principles in RevRec apply to the disposals of non-financial assets, including in substance non-financial assets. And we had a lot of questions about, what do you think you mean when you say the word in substance non-financial assets? Can a business be an in substance non-financial asset? And so our second phase of this was to clarify what we meant by in substance non-financial asset. We clarified that if you have a business, you do not have an in substance non-financial asset. But if you have a subsidiary, or I'm sorry, a legal shell around a group of assets, and substantially all of those are non-financial in nature, we would say that is, in fact, an in-substance non-financial asset. If you have a combination of both financial and non-financial assets, we would say it's not an in-substance non-financial asset. We're not going to look through. So that's phase two, but it's important that we move forward with phase one and phase two in time for the adoption of the revenue recognition standard because of the linkage to in-substance non-financial asset. As it relates to the proposal on the definition itself, like the guidance under IFRS that you proposed, we have proposed to incorporate a threshold that would indicate if substantially all of the value in the transaction is in a single asset or group of similar assets, that you don't need to go through, don't go through the further assessment of whether you have a business or not. You can definitively conclude that it is an asset group. A number of commenters, again, keep in context, we're talking about 37 in total, but a number of the commenters suggested that as opposed to being a definitive threshold, that should either be optional or an indicator or perhaps a rebuttable presumption. The board has and here we have three alternatives that the board was, we say the board will consider. In fact, subsequent to issuing, posting these slides, the board has in fact met. We've reached tentative conclusions subject to drafting, fatal flaw, and actually I think we have time to, because we're going to link it to the second phase, to hear more about the feedback that you all get on in summarizing your comments, but at least tentatively the board's concluded to affirm the conclusion that in fact the threshold is a determinative factor. Our debate ranged from make it optional at one end to why in fact would we have this factor if you have to go run the rest of the test? In fact, would it provide any relief? And I think pretty clearly the board landed on the side of, well, if we're going to have a threshold, it ought to mean something. Questions about, at least from our commenters, about what do we mean by single asset? We had some examples that said you could not combine a tangible and an intangible. Very reasonable questions about what if I have a piece of property that is subject to lease and the lease is a favorable lease. There's no way to really separate the two in terms of economically, and so we provided some guidance that said if in business combination accounting something would be accounted for as a combined asset, you could continue to treat that as a combined or single asset for this purpose, with the exception of, and then saying, however, if you're in a single asset category, if assets within that single category have substantially different risk, that those should be treated as different assets. And so, for example, if you're acquiring properties around the globe, even though that might be a single asset category called PP&E, that for purposes of the screen anyway, you shouldn't treat those as a single asset if they have substantially different risk characteristics. And again, that's where the board landed in redeliberation.
So that's A.
Yeah, that's A, yeah. Also, questions about, well, I guess that's A when you get to slide 8. Also, questions when we get to the point of the model where we're talking about what is the difference, for example, between an input and a process. So clarifying, I think it's pretty clear in the words that a assembled workforce should be treated as an input, but the collective knowledge of that workforce can provide for something that is more akin to a process, and so providing clarifying language there. I'm not sure that really what we've done really fits any view in particular. I think it's more a drafting clarification that we weren't trying to indicate that an assembled workforce itself is a process, but the knowledge of that workforce can be a part of a process. And I think those words are probably closer to what was in the proposal that you all had. Last area where we received significant comment was on simultaneous contracts. We had an example in the ED case F, if you look at slide 11, where an entity simultaneous with the transaction entered into another contract, and we had guidance that would have indicated that perhaps you combine simultaneous contracts for purpose of the assessment. A lot of questions about, well, if those are completely unrelated to the business itself, so for example, or the group of assets itself, I guess I shouldn't conclude it's a business, but I have a group of assets and at the same time I'm settling litigation or I'm doing something else. I might have two things going on at once. Do I necessarily always include those as one group for purposes of determining whether something is an asset or a business? And as opposed to providing definitive guidance, we decided to take that out of the standard and allow judgment to apply of which is the bundle that really relates to the asset transaction, the group of assets, whether it's a business or a group of assets. And so we don't think that was a pervasive, certainly wasn't a pervasive issue in practice that led to our adding this project. And so I think people were reading that as resulting in perhaps unintended consequence. Talked about phase 2, that is out for comment. In fact, the comment period ended August 5th. We received 13 comments on that one, so even less interest in commenting. It's pretty, they are pretty unusual fact patterns that we heard back from the commenters that perhaps we ought to go further getting into accounting for undivided interests. So I have an asset itself and sell a portion of the asset outside of a legal entity. How do I account for that? Not that those transactions don't occur, but the frequency with which they occur tells us perhaps, given the fact that there are only 13 commenters in total, we don't need to spend a lot of time resolving that before we move forward. But we do want to reach the conclusions on phase 2 before finalizing phase 1, so our staff's in the process of drafting the board's conclusions on phase 1, bringing back then phase 2 so that we can decide effective date and transition for the package as a whole. Again, I think that gives us opportunity to hear more from or glean more from what comments you might receive on your definition of a business project.
Okay, thanks, Jim. Are there any questions? Andrew?
Well, I can just mention that FRAG has published its tentative comment letter on the IISB version of these proposals, which is itself a consultation document under our due process, open till the 18th of October, so we welcome any input to our process. I think our tentative position is pretty consistent overall with the kind of comments you've received from your 37 respondents. We supported the direction of the project, supported the attempt to provide some perhaps pragmatic and more balanced guidance So it'd be nice if the boards could end up converged, but we've seen that converged words don't always result in converged outcomes. So convergence of outcomes is ultimately what we should be aiming for, which might be helped by convergence of words. In getting to our tentative position, I wouldn't say it was a clear-cut discussion overall. You know, on the screening test on balance, that was welcome. There were some comments around improving the clarity. I would say with that in mind, the screening test is only worth having if it's kind of pragmatic. It's intended to actually save the effort of going through a more comprehensive analysis. So if you add so many bells and whistles to it, make it so complex that you may as well just go through the complete analysis, there's no point in having the screening test. So that's just a trade-off balance to be struck. We had some discussion around whether the proposals placed too much emphasis on the role of a workforce, and some people were thinking about evolving business models that are perhaps in some cases less reliant on human capital. But on balance, I think the view was that human capital is pretty important for the time being, but you know, watch this space when all our taxis are driverless, etc. Could come before we know it. I understand that there has been some discussion around the role of deferred tax in the screening test. I think that's something that
we decided to exclude the impact of tax items in the screening test.
Okay, that makes sense. And the final comment I'd make, this suggestion that the real issue is to align the accounting between an asset purchase and a business combination, I think that's the kind of thing that's easy to say in abstract, in a comment letter. That's actually a huge step in terms of standard setting. And looking at some ISB history on things like proposals to align the initial recognition for deferred tax between asset purchases and business combinations, that was tried and failed. In looking at the accounting for variable and contingent consideration, that's a kind of work in progress. But certainly when the Interpretations Committee discussed, I guess, the current menu of options for contingent consideration in an asset purchase, the IFRS 3 approach, fair value through P&L, there wasn't an immediate groundswell of support for that approach. So I think we're quite a long way off having aligned accounting for asset purchases and business combinations. So some pragmatic guidance on definition of a business, even if it's an interim step, might be quite a long interim.
I think that's useful to remember that differences arise in numerous standards and were generated over decades. And so I think we're optimistic we can align some, but when you look at the whole list, you know, it includes things like transaction costs, as you say, contingent consideration, some differences in R&D, some pretty, and then you could go one step further and say, well, if we're going to align that, why not also then align the derecognition guidance for financial assets. So why should financial and non-financial have a different model? And then you get into
trouble. You get into
a three-decade project.
Any other comments, Cedric?
Maybe three short comments. We are still working on the proposal of the ISB, and we have not finalized our answer, but the question raised were about the screening test also, whether it should be a rather rebuttable presumption than a strict threshold, especially in certain cases where the business may be more liability driven than on the asset base, that the screening test may lead to a conclusion that may not represent that may be counterintuitive. Also in certain business where the value of asset may be so huge compared to the value of the workforce that the decision may always lead to more assets than businesses. On the theoretical point of view, we share the concerns that you expressed previously, that there are differences between asset and businesses, especially, for example, for acquisition costs? Why is there, in that case, a different accounting treatment? And finally, we wanted to address one concern about the transition provision in the case where we have created or bought a business, and this would be now an asset. If we restate the asset, what shall we do with the potential goodwill that has been recognized previously? It's one of the issues that we are still investigating.
Alberto?
Yes, we discussed this in our committee. We are generally happy with the with this document, although we noted that to really understand how it works in practice, we have to go to the illustrative example. I mean, the illustrative example are really good. The wording might be open to some difficult understanding at first sight, but the illustrative example are okay. They really explain the rationale. The only thing is that we, before expressing a definitive opinion, is we want to do a sort of empirical survey of the effect on the retail business, if there is any impact on the retail business. But generally speaking, at the moment, we are happy with this new proposed standard.
Cedric, your point on the threshold and maybe identifying things that feel more like businesses and kicking them out of the model, we talk a lot about that and our concern, and if people have suggestions of how to do that but retain the value of having a threshold, our concern, at least in a U.S. environment, was if we made it a rebuttable presumption or an indicator, people would be forced to go through the entire model anyway, because the auditor would come in or a regulator would come in and say, well, this is only a rebuttable presumption. Mm-hmm. And so you still have to go through the entire model. And if the model itself indicates differently, then the threshold of assets doesn't really indicate anything. And so whether it was really a practical screen if you had to apply the model. That and so we realized there was a trade-off because undoubtedly, there will be things that to fall through that screen that people say, that feels to me like a business, but partly that I think that's because they're, I mean, where do you take a group of assets and say in nature this, you know, this group is so clearly a business and this one isn't, and there is no natural dividing line.
So the example that we had that people were struggling with was very big shopping centres or airports, where if you went down the fair value route, then in comparison to the fair value, nothing is going to come up and be significant. But it kind of feels like it is a business because there's so much involved in that airport or that shopping centre. And so that, I'm not sure whether that was the same sort of examples that you were concerned about. But
yeah, and the example that was used most by commenters was an acquisition by a bank of a portfolio of a lending portfolio, including all of the existing loans, but bringing over a few employees, where I think some of the financial institutions said, well, this feels like a business to them, I guess because the employees came over. Others of us on the board felt that maybe in that situation the employees weren't so critical, and that you did have, in fact, a group of assets and not a business, particularly when you think about the financial reporting outcome of allocating part of the purchase price to goodwill. If you conclude that's a business and then increasing the yield on the acquired mortgages, and of course, goodwill wouldn't be amortized. So, do you really have a business or do you have a group of assets? But we didn't, I don't think your examples are probably ones that are more troubling in terms of, is that a business or not?
In line with that, have you considered wet leases? So if you think of airlines that are leasing out aircraft plus personnel, everything, could that come under that definition and could it become a business, and as of when? We currently do have in our country a case where the market leader engages in a big wet lease. We were thinking of test driving this against the proposed amendment.
So if they sold several aircraft subject to the...
Exactly. But it is not an outright sale of, it's really done as a lease, and that's the interesting bit. You could hold the view that since you now have acquired a right to use, that's the easy part, but what do you do with the personnel? You don't acquire the personnel, but given that it is a wet lease, you at least have access to all the HR and the workforce, and that creates tension as to are we now in or outside of business.
But Andreas, just thinking about that one very, very quickly, so very superficially, and I'm thinking about the leasing standard, is it maybe that you acquired an asset and also acquired the contract for services delivered with that? So it isn't that it's a business, but it's that you've acquired the aircraft and you've also bought a contract that means it's just turn up and use it. You don't have to organize all those things. I don't know that makes it a business as opposed to just service contract.
I think it becomes probably not as clear cut, really.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you're akin this to a hotel where you've got hotel staff that come with it, I mean, quite clearly I'd say that you could view this as a business. For instance, if you are an airline that just serviced Europe before, and you wet lease now the equipment to do business in America. Question is have you really just bought aircraft or rights to use an aircraft plus service out some personnel, or have you really acquired a business? And I would be very, very nervous if you could structure around that. So if you could really make the contract such that you achieve whatever you desire, I would presume that it could become quite easy, actually. And if then there is differential treatment between acquiring a business and wet leasing, I would become nervous, really.
So there's also the tension, because there's a bit in the ISB one that says that an acquired contract could be a process if you've got access to an organised workforce.
Yes, and we talked about that one, and we decided at least, a workforce is necessary when there aren't outputs, and we said in that fact pattern, we would say it has to be a workforce. It can't be the acquired contract.
We should come back to that, because I think there is some differences in the wordings. But I think picking up on your point, mm-hmm. It doesn't matter what happens here, it's going to be structured.
And that's why I think a lot of us were frustrated at appreciating the point that eliminating the differences is a big project. It felt like, as I said earlier, just pushing on the balloon, because we're drawing a binary line between something that is a continuum, all the way from I have a lawnmower and I push it around and mow somebody's yard and collect a fee. Is that a business if I acquire the, but how many, if I have 50 lawnmowers and a staff of people that do it, we got into cleaning services, if you bought in the States, it's called Merry Maids, which is clearly a business, versus I acquire, a bunch of cleaning supplies. Well, that doesn't feel like a business, but where is that line?
In these cases where maybe the filter seems to be filtering out the wrong stuff, if I can put it that way, I'm very interested in any examples from real life where that would be the case. But I think also in thinking about that, we should concentrate on, for those particular real-world fact patterns, how much difference does it actually make? There's a long list of potential differences between business combination and asset purchase accounting, but not all of those are material or eventuate in real life situations. So we've been through the exercise of thinking of theoretical situations and saying, and if we put in a big initial recognition on deferred tax and some contingent consideration and huge transaction costs to come up with a big difference. But actually, if none of those things are there or material, it comes down probably to disclosure differences in the situation where substantially all the fair value is concentrated in a single asset, I should emphasise. Not minimising the importance of disclosures, but let's look at the consequences as well as the theoretical distinction.
Okay, I think it's time to move on to the next paper.
Thank you, Alex.
Leonardo.
Yes, in agenda paper 5B, we compare the wording of the ISB exposure draft with the wording of the FASB exposure draft. Today, I want to focus on two wording differences. The first one is in page 6. It relates to the assessment of concentration fair value. You can see in the table in page 6, on the right side, we have the ISB exposure draft, and in the left side, you have the FASB exposure draft. We added the sentence highlighted in yellow. The sentence says that the gross assets acquired may be calculated by adding the fair value of the liability assumed to the consideration paid. We added this sentence because we are concerned about measuring at fair value non-identifiable assets. This is one, in my opinion, one of the main differences between the ISB exposure draft and the FASB exposure draft. The other one was mentioned before by Chris, is in page 11. You can see in the table in page 11, the last page, again, on the left side, there is the FASB exposure draft, and on the right side, there is the ISB exposure draft. Especially in the second part, we added the sentence highlighted in yellow in paragraph B12C of the ISB exposure draft. Both the proposal says that an acquired outsourcing agreement may provide access to a substantive process. And this is similar in both exposure draft. However, we added this sentence to specify that the acquired should assess whether the outsourcing workforce performs a substantive process and whether the acquired controls that substantive process. For example, considering the duration of the contract. So in my view, these are the most significant wording differences between the two exposure drafts. Our question for you are in page 2 of the paper. The first question is if you have any advice regarding the wording differences between the two proposals, including any differences in practice that could emerge as a result of the different wording. And the second question is if you have any other advice on the ISB exposure draft on the definition of a business.
Andreas.
As to the first question, I wouldn't be bothered so much about the wording differences because I think Jim said the purpose was really to get both constituencies to arrive at the same answer. And I think as long as that is the overarching objective, I think I would give that a higher priority than the same wording, but that would then result in different applications. So I would rather see the same application arising, and if that can only be achieved by different wording, so be it. It probably, you might think about including something in the basis for conclusion where you highlight the difference in the wording and say this is not to mean different things, but it's meant to arrive at the same outcome. Yeah. As to the other bit, proposed amendments on the ISB standards, we have finalized our conclusions and you will be receiving our comment letter shortly. We are certainly behind what Andrew said. We are clearly behind the clarifications and the project. Our problem was more applying the principles and reconciling those to the examples provided. Because we thought we understood the principles, then we saw the examples and found out out there something was happening here. So either we were wrong, or the examples were wrong, or the principles were wrong, but all of the above. So you might want to look into this. And I mean, you were highlighting, Jim, the importance of an input in the process. And we were thinking about it would help tremendously, I think, if in the examples you outline, this is a business or is not the business, because this is the input, this is the process, so that you really drive the reader through the thought process. Because sometimes we were thinking, is workflows now an input, or is it a process, or what exactly is it now? And is it necessary, or is it not necessary? We were confused, simply. So it's aligning the examples with the principles in the front end.
Okay, we will check. I think that they are aligned. But,
but your point is then talk about which is which and how you reach, more clearly, how you reach the conclusion,
yeah,
in the context of the framework.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Thank you. We are not fully convinced that the two boards need different words to come to the same answer. I think if we can agree with the same answer, the boards can still work to get to the same wording. That would be our first preference. But if that's not the case, we agree with Andreas' suggestion that at least you write in the standards for both boards that you intend to have the same answer, so that it's been made clear that even the words might be different, you really intend to have the same answer.
Linda?
Yeah, just to build on what others have said, you know, just a reminder that for our largest companies, about 70% prepare statements under IFRS and 30% prepare statements under U.S. GAAP that file with the SEC. And I'm just throwing that out there. So ideally, in our environment, it would be simpler in an ideal world if the words were the same. And the dilemma that you both boards face is that you're actually trying to get to the same reporting outcome. And so we actually are very supportive of that, and we say that in the comment letters, that we are less focused on, you know, the word convergence in the standard as opposed to the similar reporting outcomes. So we support that. So I feel like, you know, each of you has to try to guess how your people are going to apply it and try to get to the same spot, however you do that. My sympathies for that. But so that would be what we would support. So anything you can do to message that you intend for the outcomes to be the same, certainly from our perspective, will be helpful. And in just as anecdotally, the first week of the month, we were down in Washington talking to our friends at the SEC in the Chief Accountants Department, and we were talking about the nature of the Canadian preparers and how we have this kind of split reporting and stuff. And this whole notion of, you know, trying to get their view, the SEC's view on IFRS particular and when it should be the same as US GAAP or not, it's an intriguing mindset down in Washington. So the point is, somebody told me the other day I was diplomatic, so I'm trying to exercise that. Okay.
Very much so.
Okay. So, anything you can do to say we intend for these to be the same would be hugely helpful.
One thing I found in my recollection is that comment came even through some of the major accounting firms, and the odd thing is that they're the ones that are reaching the different conclusions when the words are identical. So they're trying to say, make sure you have converged words, but then leave it to us around the world to apply it differently.
I know.
One heat.
Yes. As for wording difference, I guess AOT standards are more focused on the exact the similarity or exact the sameness between the FASB and IFRS. So members highlighted that the wording of IFRS and the FASB standard should be as aligned as possible. And in this regard, they pointed out that the FASBD is clearer in terms of defining the concept organized workforce. FASBD says that an organized workforce could consist of employees and or certain contractual arrangements that take the place of employees. Whereas in the ISBD, there is only an indirect description that the acquired set of activities and assets include an organized workforce with the necessary skills, knowledge, or experience to perform and acquire the process. So since the concept organized workforce is one of the critical elements in the assessment of substantive process, members say that the ISB should incorporate a similar definition of organized workforce as aligned as the one in the FASB ED. And regarding the question of the agenda paper, some members expressed a concern that the screening test might result in unintended consequences in certain acquisitions where transactions which are business acquisition is falsely accounted for as asset acquisition. For example, when an acquisition contains an organized workforce, which is critical to the production of outputs, the screening test might result in the acquisition being accounted for as an asset acquisition. This is because an organized workforce often represents an insignificant portion of the overall fair value. So that member suggested a kind of solution that it recommended that the board consider including a rebuttable presumption that the acquired set of activities and assets is not a business if substantially all of the fair value of the gross assets acquired are concentrated in a single identifiable asset or group of similar assets, and this presumption can be overcome in limited circumstances prescribed by board. So that's one thing. And another example with regard to the unintended consequence in certain acquisitions where transactions which are business acquisitions falsely accounted for as asset acquisition is the case where the consideration paid is used as a surrogate measure of the fair value of the gross assets acquired. For example, if an acquirer underpays for an acquiree, the fair value, the amount of the consideration paid, would be lower than the true fair value of the gross assets. In that case, the entity might conclude that substantially all of the fair value of the gross assets is concentrated in a single identifiable asset. Then, as there will be no further assessment, it would result in an accounting error. So to prevent this from happening, we could consider elaborating on paragraph 11A of the ED, where the fair value of the gross assets may be determined by the consideration paid. So the word maybe is vague, and we might change this wording to include a condition that the consideration paid can be used as a surrogate measure only when the consideration approximates the true fair value instead of using the word maybe. But having said that, this could also create another difficulty. This is because such a condition would cause a practical burden to examine whether the consideration paid exactly or approximates the true value. And moreover, if the entity can calculate the true fair value, then there will be no need to perform the screening test and the assessment of substantive process. So the member noticed that there is a conflict between a clearer requirement and practical burden. So at least it would be necessary to perform this kind of analysis and explain this limitation in the PC. And my final comment is regarding the flowchart. One member suggested including a more detailed flowchart of the assessment process by linking the process with the examples in the ED. And I will deliver our comments in writing after the meeting, and I will include the flowchart in the written comments.
Chris.
So also supportive of getting to the same outcomes, but I did have a question, because if you go to page 8, where it has the differences between US and ISB, and this is where you've got a set of activities and the asset doesn't have outputs, it seems like the ISB is more restrictive because it says you can only get to a business if you've got an organised workforce. But I didn't read the US wording as saying that was only. It seemed to be that that was an example of when you did get there, but there could be other potential circumstances.
My recollection is we clarified in redeliberations, but I looked at the minutes again this morning and I couldn't see that written in the minutes, but I thought we clarified that you had to have an assembled workforce if you didn't have outputs, that it was a requirement, not an indicator.
Okay, so
and this is very clear in the examples.
Yeah.
But my recollection is we clarified that, but I don't know if you remember listening.
I suppose that's my other sort of question. It's clear if you have only an organised workforce that you don't have a business, but I guess it's not so clear, and I certainly didn't find it in the basis for conclusions, why you had to it seems like you almost have to have an organised workforce in every scenario.
And that's my if it's not, I'll raise it as a point of why do we have, is this a conscious difference or is it a wording?
Yeah, but I think it's also just as a general principle. I don't have a particular problem if that's where we land, that you always have to have an organised workforce, but then I think we just need to support why.
Mary.
comments on two or three of the items raised in the discussion, and I'll start with one. He's observation about the comment about you can calculate, you know, you may calculate it this way. That actually was a comment that got raised as we were in connection with a webcast we did about this ED recently. So had spotted it then too. Agree with your analysis that permission to calculate it that way would be bad to force somebody to do it that way because it does not work when you have negative goodwill. Sorry, I think I'm not supposed to call it negative goodwill anymore, but but that's the time when it does, so agree with that analysis. I wanted to jump on board with Jim's comments about how the good idea of a screening mechanism can lose all its value if you try to complicate it and make it softer and more judgmental. So I think that's something we'll have to remind ourselves to think about if we're looking at comments that are soften it, make it rebuttable, etc. And the third thing is I very much understand and the sentiment about express clearly if your objectives are the same, and it was something we encountered a number of times in connection with the IFRS 15 clarification amendments. But I think one of the things we also became aware of is we have to be very careful about how we do it and how we limit it, because if you don't, it then implies that any additional guidance on this point that's then issued by either body is automatically incorporated, in the other direction. And I think that's not the intent. So I think we can talk about what the intent is at the time, but I don't think we can give broad assurances that we are always trying to reach the same same point in this. And so it has to be, I think, by nature, a very limited comment about when, if we chose different words, was it because we were trying to reach different outcomes or not?
I strongly agree with that point. I think if the boards can agree on the same words, fantastic. But ultimately, the two boards are accountable to different constituencies. And if you don't agree on the same words, the presumption should be maybe just at the margins, there might be some different outcomes. And of course, we're dealing with judgments in any case. So let's not strive for a sort of false degree of precision, which is far more kind of narrow than the range of judgment that's going to be inherent in this type of guidance anyway. But just on one detailed point, Leonard, I wasn't quite sure if your list of the more important differences included the difference of words right at the very end of the paper on page 11 on an outsourcing contract. If I'm reading that correctly, on the outsourcing contract, the FASB words say the acquired process has to be critical to the ability, etc., and the ISB words say substantive process. So we talked about terms of likelihood, etc., at the IFAS meeting, but I thought critical seems a slightly narrower subset than substantive. So this might drive different conclusions on the determinativeness of an outsourcing contract.
We talked about that in our deliberations, and I think we stayed closer to where we're at. We struggled a little bit with the notion of control in terms of an outsourcing contract, and how would one determine whether they have, how do you apply a control model in an outsourced contract, and does that say other things about the outsourced contract in terms of whether or not, you know, if you control the contract, obviously leases has a scope that is limited to those types of things, but if you control other contracts, does that start getting into why don't you have other executory contracts that you control on your balance sheet? So we didn't want to wade into that territory.
Any other comments? No?